Hello and welcome to Gascast. Coming up, we're going to be looking at the new evidence for acupuncture published in the BJA, discussing the paradigm-shifting FEAST trial, and looking at just how accurate your anaesthetic chart really is. All of this, plus our regular features that we've just spent somewhere between 2 months and 10 minutes preparing. I'm Rick Thomas, and joining me after a holiday-induced hiatus are Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Frank Schneider.
Hello.
Frank Schneider.
Hello.
Sorry about that. I'll edit something in that is actually your name rather than me forgetting it. And of course Rebecca Smith and her slightly insensate perineum.
Hi Rick.
I just wanted to congratulate you on your cycle ride from London to Paris. Very impressive.
Thank you.
And are you harbouring any other lasting injuries?
I'm still missing the sensation in my left little finger. So CPAP with a AST piece is tricky at the moment, but I'm working on it.
So we'll start with our first section, Discovery of the Month. I'm always excited to hear what everyone else has found to innovate their practice. Frank, what have you got for us?
I can't remember what my Discovery of the Month was. Was that just the sign network, wasn't it? We get my game with that.
I've got a new one.
Well, I'll just go with the same thing. I've got a new one as well, but I was saving that for next time.
You can't stockpile them.
Of course you can.
Well, you can.
Rick's been doing the same.
That's true, I do that a lot.
Actually, I've got a note called Discovery of the Month on my iPhone, and I keep them in there.
Nice. You could have that as your Discovery of the Month. You've learned to make lists on your iPhone.
Okay, well, let me go.
Frank, why don't you give us one of your many discoveries?
I've got some, not to wish on about apps for smartphones, but what I came across this month was a new app which you'll be pleased to hear exists for both the iOS or iPhone platform as well as Android, and it is just a new logbook. Many of us with iPhones have been using iGasLog, which I use and it seems to work very well for me. But for those who are interested in exploring other options, there is an app called Online Anesthesia, and you can find that either on the iTunes App Store or on the Android Marketplace. And it's a free app, which may make it more attractive, and seems to do much the same job as any other anesthetic logbook, and will obviously enable you to keep track of your anesthetic cases, and you can export in the same way as you can with other apps to produce reports like we require for our appraisals, or indeed to match the College of Anesthetists logbook format. So that's called Online Anesthesia, and if you want to check it out, as I said, just go to the iTunes App Store or Android Marketplace.
And why is it better than iGasLog?
I don't think it is better as such. I think that the main attraction from the people who've used it, who've downloaded it, is that you don't have to pay. I can't remember how much iGasLog is. I think it's around 20 quid, is it?
Is that a subscription or a one-off?
Well, it used to be a one-off, and then there was always talk about it being a subscription service, which did then give you the benefit of keeping a backup on their server. But then that was going to become an annual subscription, which hasn't materialized as far as I know. But Online Anesthesia is completely free so far.
Logbook money-saving tips right there. Mark, what pearls of wisdom have you got for us?
Yeah, it's very simple, and I'm sure some of you guys probably knew this already, but I found out this week that you can't use beta blockers to treat cocaine overdose.
Why not?
More importantly, how did you find that out?
Yeah, I didn't find it out the hard way. Fortunately, somebody told me, but had they not, I would have probably thought it was a reasonable idea. But apparently, because beta blockers are only blocking beta receptors, you get an unopposed alpha reaction, which causes their brain to explode.
Is it sort of...
it's a hypertensive crisis that you get.
So it's an implode and explode kind of phenomenon. Yep.
So,
horrible.
Mm. That's it, really.
That was news to me. That was clearly news to Bex. News to Frank?
Well, I remember being taught that on an ALS at some point.
Can I go next, continuing on the same theme?
Go for it.
I discovered this month the phenomenon of epiduroscopy,
what?
Which I'd not come across.
Or intentional? Intentional or accidental?
No, intentional. I think people have been doing it since the early 90s. No, you think I was trying to endoscope something else and ended up in the epidural space. Not quite sure where I would start and how wrong it would have had to have gone. Can't remember what I was looking at. It was breaking down of epidural adhesions, and I was sort of thinking, how do you do that? Is that a surgical thing? It came up with when I was looking at a pain article, and then it had a reference to somebody doing epiduroscopy, and I thought I must have misunderstood, because I didn't understand how you could possibly get an endoscope into this sort of potential space. But if you go onto YouTube and you YouTube epiduroscopy, there are videos of people actually doing it, which is fascinating. It's like sort of most endoscopy, when you first look at it, you can't really tell what's going on. But I think the basis is they're sort of going into the epidural space and breaking down adhesions that occur after spinal surgery. But what's even more frightening is the sort of equipment needed to do it, because you access the epidural space, I think, through the sacral hiatus. And you really do need quite a big kind of introducer needle. And then the scope, whilst being quite a small endoscope, is still fairly sizable. And the whole thing looks fairly horrific. But I think some case series with good results. But I'd never, ever heard of it before. And some people in America and I think in Europe have been doing it since the 90s.
And did they mention at all what their complication rates are?
No, they didn't actually mention the complication rates. There were lots of videos, and it looked like people sort of in private practice in Europe and America saying it's very safe. We've got loads of really good results with people who have had back pain. But a lot of people have surgical intervention for their back surgery and then end up having chronic pain afterwards. And I think for some reason it's not attributed to whatever their original problem was, but attributed to the surgery they've had. And one of the theories is they get adhesions in the epidural space, and that's the cause of the back pain. So then you go and see your pain doctor who does this epiduroscopy and breaks down the adhesions.
Yeah.
Really interesting, though. I've not come across it in this country, but I think there was a reference to somebody who does it around here. But yeah, it was news to me, very interesting. I wonder if anybody else had heard of it.
Never.
No, I hadn't.
Not at all. Although,
I've got to say, use of endoscopy in wider fields is seems to be on the increase. I mean, I remember doing a few lists now where they were doing endoscopic wrist surgery, and where I am at the moment, they do endovascular harvesting of veins for coronary artery bypass grafting, and it all looks pretty slick, I've got to say, and you get much better views than I would have thought were possible.
I'm looking at the videos now, Rick. Did you find any evidence that this is any good, or is it not just something flashy that sounds good and doesn't do anything, like lots of back pain treatments?
Honestly, I did not look into it hard enough.
Well, there's something for next time.
There is something for next time. There were loads of case series and people saying that it was good stuff, but I didn't see any randomized controlled trials or anything. But I will have a look and get back to you for next time.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. And Rebecca, what have you got to wow us with after that?
Well, I've discovered something, not personally, but come across something called Melnick Needles Syndrome. And this syndrome is one of a spectrum of the otopalatodigital disorders. And it was a patient that I came across in my pediatric practice. And as you can guess from the name, these patients have hearing loss because of malformations of the ossicles in the ear. Their palate develops abnormally, and they've got low skeletal deformities. And with relevance to anesthetic, they typically have scoliosis, a grossly abnormal rib cage, micrognathia, misaligned teeth, facial asymmetry, renal failure, and cardiac defects. So they tend to suffer from upper airway obstruction, which is why they're of interest anesthetically. And there are less than 100 cases reported worldwide. So I was pretty chuffed to find one.
You can tell you're back at a tertiary centre, Bex.
And from that interesting discovery onto our news items. And Mark, why don't we start with you? You've been looking at a paper in this month's BJA about anaesthetic records and the debate between computerized automated records and whether or not we should actually be writing them by hand.
That's right. So this article was written by a group of anaesthetists from New Zealand, and what I found interesting about it was, as they state, that that there are plenty of studies that show that there are smoothing and inaccuracies in handwritten anesthetic records. Who of us hasn't left out the occasional distressing number on an anesthetic chart?
Is that what smoothing is?
Smoothing, yeah. You don't put the highest values, you don't put the lowest values. It's like damping on an art line.
So you document the anesthetic that you wish you'd given as opposed to the one you did.
Right. So that doesn't surprise me at all. So what these guys have set out to establish is, does this smoothing and inaccuracy actually have any clinical relevance? And what interested me about this study is how difficult it was for them to come up with a methodology to assess that. I mean, how would you do it? What they've ended up doing is collecting a load of manual and automated records from the same anesthetics, and then digitizing the manual ones to look like they were recorded in the same way as the automated ones, filling in the gaps by kind of extrapolating as the automated records would record more frequently than the manual ones. And then they selected a sample of what the authors thought to be the most unstable anesthetics out of all the records that they collected. And then they gave these 24 anesthetic records to 10 randomly selected consultants and asked them to kind of play through these records in real time and indicate on the chart at which point they would intervene in some way and what type of intervention. So they basically, it was like a web-based interface they use, and they could press a button and tick a box for giving fluid or giving an inotrope or increasing the ventilation, you know, simple interventions like that. So it was
basically a very convoluted way of getting an automated record and a simultaneously taken written record,
yeah,
making them both look the same in kind of a web-based format,
right,
or so that, not so that they look the same, sorry, but so they're presented in the same,
that's right,
way,
yeah,
and then getting the people to look through them in kind of an accelerated time scale,
yeah,
and then click and say, I would have done something here, I would have given fluids, here I would have given an inotrope, here I would have called for help, here I would have gone for a cup of tea, that type of thing.
Exactly. So by the end of this all, they reckon that the mean number of interventions per anaesthetic was significantly higher for the automated records, i.e. in the manually recorded ones, things were slipping by where interventions were being given when the records were automated, if you follow me. The big leap of faith, as I see it, is do these interventions or, you know, intended interventions by the assessing anaesthetists, this study doesn't address whether those interventions were actually needed or whether, I mean, how would you assess whether the outcomes would be or were any different? I guess there's only so far you can go with trials. But I just thought it was a very interesting way to try to work out whether or not this made any difference.
The issue I have with electronic records, though, is I do find myself, or I initially had to really get used to keeping an eye on the record, because at least when you're making a paper chart, you do have to consciously go and look at all the numbers and write them down. Whereas especially in cardiac surgery, I mean, sometimes where we work now, all the alarms are off anyway. You don't have a pulse beat for the ECG or the pulse oximetry. So sometimes you realize that you've not been keeping as close an eye on the numbers as you otherwise would have, perhaps.
Yeah, that's more of a worry for me than not being able to explain erroneous numbers, is the fact that the process of recording means you have to stay involved.
Yeah, if I don't know if anyone's checked out the website, but if you look at the references for this article, they actually give the address for the website that you. I mean, if you're interested in this, you can go and have a look at.
It's anaesthetist.com.
You can play along yourself.
You can play along yourself, and they've got a button that you can click on to say if you think that's an artifact, from what I gather. I mean, I haven't done a whole case, but anyone with an interest in this might want to go and have a look at the website to get an idea as to what the study or how the study was conducted.
Although they do go into, this is one of my favourite things about this particular paper, incredible detail about all the different programs they've used, all the different versions. I never knew that PNG stood for Portable Network Graphic. They've really gone to town with explaining everything. But what's even better is they've released the source code, I think, for part of the project. So if you can get it, you can actually kind of get it going at your own hospital. Mm.
I thought that would appeal to your inner geek, Rick.
Not so inner.
To be honest, it was. Not so, I did. I was reading. I was like, "Oh, this is great. This is like reading a computer magazine. Lovely." But yeah, no, it was way beyond me. But I enjoyed it nonetheless. I enjoyed the attention to detail and pedantry in spelling out file extension names.
I happen to know as well, though, that this crowd, and I mean, they obviously do declare a conflict of interest, but clearly, one of the main author here is. Is a major shareholder in Safer Sleep, and as far as I know from a friend who actually works in this hospital, they've been pioneering a whole lot of electronic systems, not just limited to record keeping, but also to electronic and computerized drug prescription and delivery systems. So you actually just sort of type in, you know, the dose or whatever you want, and it will deliver that drug to you, and it's, I mean, some of the Draeger machines have got that functionality available as well, apparently. But
so basically, they're trying to make a robot anaesthetist.
Yeah, well, and they're trying to, you know, they're trying to establish systems for sort of closed loop anaesthetics in much the same way as we do with volatiles, but trying to incorporate intravenous drugs with that by the use of infusion pumps and things like that.
Wouldn't that be absolutely fantastic? I don't know if any of you have done a robot sort of Da Vinci.
Oh yeah, I've done one of those
robot prostatectomies. Yeah. That take 14 hours. Wouldn't it be fantastic if you said to the surgeon, sorry, we're going to have to start at 2 o'clock in the morning because we're doing a robot anesthetic. And you have to sort of climb into your thing and take, you know, 8 times as long as it would normally to anesthetize the patient. But
I look forward to the day.
So, moving on to my article, which by complete coincidence comes from the same edition of the BJA as Mark's, which I think is only a testament to what a fantastic journal the BJA is, and was an article on electroacupuncture. Acupuncture is an interesting subject. Quite recently did my intermediate pain module, and I was surprised when the hospital I was working at that they actually were offering acupuncture in the pain clinic. And this prompted me to go and sort of look at the NICE guidelines and sort of question why was the NHS paying for this. And it was there in the recent 2000 NICE guidelines for patients who were who weren't getting sort of relief with their chronic back pain. Acupuncture was one of the next places you put them to. And it was being offered on the NHS, and they trained up a nurse to do it. Now, my perception of these type of alternative therapies were that, yeah, I mean, they do work, but they're always only as good as placebo effect. And we know this is pretty much what it is. And I think it's been fairly well proven now that any effect you get from homeopathy is not only placebo effect, but it's to do with the effect of the clinician spending time taking an interest in the patient. But the acupuncture that was done at the hospital I was working at, they'd only trained up one nurse, and the queue for it was massive. So she didn't have any time to have any consultation with these patients. She just went in, plonk, 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 put the needles in, left them for 20 minutes, came, whipped them out, and off they went. And some of them did better, some of them didn't. There was obviously no numbers on that, or no one had sort of had a look. But some people did like it and was looking really good. So what really interested me about this study was that they were using an animal model, which was interesting for two
points. It's a hedgehog.
Nice. No, they were dogs. And that was the first thing that interested me, was that dogs have acupuncture points, but there was a reference to some veterinary acupuncture thing. But that was the first thing. But the second thing was that I thought, this is a really interesting way to try and prove your point about acupuncture. Anyone who's going to make an argument against this, is the first thing they're going to say, it's placebo effect, it's mind medicine, it's consultation, this or that. But as soon as you do it with a dog, then you've kind of removed that component. And you've removed that component even further if, like in this study, you do it to the dog when they're anaesthetized. So what they did is they got 12 dogs who were having a very standard operation, which was, they were female dogs who were being neutered. and they were randomized into one of two arms. One was an acupuncture arm, and one was an arm using a drug called butorphanol, which is a partial mu agonist, I think. Either way, it's a very, very commonly used veterinary drug, so this is completely standard. The acupuncture is meant to take 40 minutes to take effect. So all the dogs were anaesthetized, whatever arm they were on, 40 minutes before the operation, put to sleep, and then those dogs who were having the acupuncture had the needles placed according to the veterinary book. And then they went on and had their standard operation with a fairly standardized anaesthetic. The anaesthetic being isoflurane, I think, ventilation. And those dogs who were on the butorphanol arm had their normal, however many milligrams per kilogram, butorphanol. But the ones on the acupuncture arm were anaesthetized, as in hypnotized the isoflurane, but had no analgesia other than the acupuncture. So the needles were kept in place while they had the operation. They took measurements of the amount of anaesthetic used during the operation, which I'll come to in a minute. But then what was interesting, even further interesting, was after the operation, the needles were obviously removed because you can't have them walking around. They're not going to tolerate walking around with needles in them. But they were then, the dogs were all observed for 24 hours by blinded observers who used some kind of standardized test to tell whether or not the dogs were in pain. It's a scoring system, and then administer rescue analgesia. And the other bit of it was they placed an intravenous cannula in, or I think it was an intra-arterial cannula, where they took beta endorphin levels. So the results were, in the in terms of which dogs in the postoperative period were given rescue analgesia, none out of six in the acupuncture group were given any, but four out of six in the control group were given some, which is obviously significant, even in spite of the small numbers. The pain scores themselves were significant all the way through, and the acupuncture group seemed to have less pain. And the they were taking beta endorphin levels off the dog sort of every hour, I think it was, or every 2 hours, because this is one of the mechanisms why via which acupuncture is meant to work. Not quite sure why it releases these endorphins, but obviously endorphins are natural mu and I think kappa, I can't remember, agonists. And the beta endorphin levels were higher, significantly higher at two time points, but it wasn't overall massively convincing. The other finding that was interesting was that whilst they were anaesthetized, the isoflurane levels were significantly lower in the acupuncture group at 2 points during the anaesthetic, and there were painful points, one of them being ovarian traction. So overall, I actually found it, someone who's very skeptical about this kind of stuff, and I always think, you know, it's far more psychological, as I mentioned before, I was massively impressed with the sort of scientific thought that had gone behind it and the way it sort of overcame, I felt, many of the arguments. Now, my first thought was, I must be missing something. This, to me, looks like a great piece of work for alternative medicine people and acupuncturists in general. What on earth is it doing in the British Journal of Anesthesia? This is potentially groundbreaking stuff. Why is it not in Pain, or at least a pain journal? Or it certainly should be in the Daily Mail. Like, this is. I mean,
this is a
nuts letter. For this. Acupuncture in dogs reaching statistical significance. They're having operations with no analgesia. That was transferred that to no anaesthetic. But I thought, why is this in the BJA? I must have misunderstood something. There were some odd references. One of the other things I should mention is the acupuncture they were using was electroacupuncture, which is slightly different from normal acupuncture. The theory is the same. It's to do with these meridian points, but the difference is they use they put the needles in and then use electrical pulses through the needle, which has been apparently shown to be more effective. There were some odd references, though. For instance, one of the ones they were talking about this method of electroacupuncture and that had been shown to be more effective. The title of the article they were referencing was "Use of Acupuncture in Equine Reproduction," which I thought was probably quite a leap. And the other thing was, when they were comparing these beta endorphin levels, they really needed a control group who hadn't had an operation or hadn't had any butorphanol, because you don't really know what the sort of beta endorphin level variability throughout the day in a dog that hasn't been injured is. So there was no control group and no comparison there. But it was still quite a convincing, I thought a convincing piece, I thought a nicely done piece of work, quite a convincing argument. And I was just surprised, why is it in the BJA? Other than it's obviously a great journal.
And tell us the answer to that or not.
No, I don't
know. Conundrum.
I was hoping you guys
would
talk about it. I was going to say the reason it was rubbish, Rick, was because...
Well, what you mean, apart from the fact that it's animal studies in a very small group, and we don't know how that translates into meridian points in humans.
No, Frank, even if it doesn't translate to meridian points in humans, it's still amazing.
But what I'm amazing is, I mean, there must be studies on this kind of thing in humans.
I mean, what, from a third world, or how are they going to get...
Perhaps literature is not that accessible, but I mean...
approval for that.
No, but if you look at... I mean, there must be Chinese medicine studies on this. I mean, I remember at medical school being lectured on acupuncture for pain relief and them quoting studies where they do cesarean sections using acupuncture and nothing else and that kind of thing.
But I think there's probably quite a wealth of case studies of things being done like that, but this was a randomized controlled trial.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I think it was a good effort. I suppose.
As you've said, the control wasn't great because there wasn't a no treatment control. The sample size was small,
and the endpoint
is difficult to interpret, as it's a biochemical marker.
No, I don't think. I think the endpoint on the they used a standardized way of observing the patient of the dog's pain postoperatively, and the observers were blinded, and the pain scores were significantly less throughout the 24-hour period of observation. None of them needed any rescue analgesia, whereas 66% of the butyrenorphin, whatever this beta agonist, this partial agonist that they use, did, and that's, you know, even with to reach statistical significance, if you've got that big a difference, you don't need the big numbers.
Well, I think it is a good article for veterinary surgeons with an interest in acupuncture, but I do wonder how applicable it is to our practice. The other thing I thought was interesting, though, is the bit about nausea, because wasn't it found that I think there were four out of the six in the acupuncture group, four of the six dogs had vomiting, whereas none in the other group, which just seemed a bit counterintuitive, given that, I mean, there is reasonably good evidence of acupuncture use to prevent postoperative nausea and vomiting.
Well, it depends how you use the acupuncture, isn't it? It depends which meridian you use. If you use the anti-sickness ones, then obviously it does. But, you know, you're right. They weren't using it as an endpoint, but I think it was either four out of six or all of the dogs who had acupuncture needed anti-emesis.
And I suppose you wouldn't want to stimulate both the anti emetic acupuncture points and the analgesic acupuncture points.
I've no idea. I was putting away in the title when I found out that dogs had.
Yeah, I'm lost. Yeah. I know our medical school isn't famed for its anatomy, but I did not know where the meridian points are.
My brother's a vet, so I'll have to ask him.
I'll tell you why. While we're talking about why things are rubbish, you mentioned the nice guidance on back pain, and I'm surprised you didn't realise why that's rubbish. that recommends physio, manipulation, acupuncture, and ultimately surgery. If you just take a quick look at the guideline development group, it is not surprisingly made up of physios, chiropractors, acupuncturists, and orthopedic surgeons. I don't think there are any pain specialists on there.
Isn't that true of most nice guidance, though?
Possibly. After such scandalous revelations, we should probably move on. Frank, you've been looking at as I said in the intro, a paradigm-shifting paper, something that may in the future very much change the way we look at all of our patients. I remember when I was a house officer and I was nervous about prescribing fluids and checking everyone's U's and E's and thought I could kill someone with 200 mils of 5% dextrose, one of my registrars said to me that basically everybody in the hospital, including the staff, would benefit from a bag of fluids. But the FEAST trials come along and told us that's not in fact the case.
Well, that's right, Rick, and we've had a range of articles this time around, and I would like to take you to Africa for this, and if you bear with me, the FEAST trial, as you as you mentioned, stands for fluid expansion as supportive therapy. And the reason I picked this was because I do think it's interesting that it does challenge a widely held belief, certainly in Western medicine circles, as to the efficacy of fluid resuscitation in pediatric patients presenting with signs of poor peripheral perfusion. And I think none of us would really hesitate to give fluid boluses in this setting. And this group, who were led by Catherine Maitland, looked at a number of centers in Africa, that were hospitals in Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania. And they looked at children aged over 60 days with severe febrile illnesses and signs of impaired perfusion. And these kids were then were randomized into either a 20 to 40 ml per kilogram bolus of 5% albumin, which was the albumin bolus group, or alternatively the same dose of normal saline, or a third group of no bolus, which was the control group. That was one stratum of the trial, and there was those kids who were more severely hypertensive weren't included in that, but were randomized to receiving boluses only. So therefore they were obviously felt not to be appropriate for a control group and not to receive a bolus at all. And what's interesting about the results, or I'll tell you first of all that the primary endpoints were 48-hour mortality, and then the secondary endpoints they looked at included pulmonary edema, obviously the concern being a fluid overload, and in kids who were often showing signs of sepsis, as well as raised intracranial pressure and mortality or neurological sequelae at 4 weeks. The results were interesting because they showed that, in fact, the trial was halted after 3,141 patients, I think, and they were aiming for 3,600 to be enrolled. And they showed that 48-hour mortality was 10.6 and 10.5 in the albumin and saline boluses respectively, but only 7.3 in the control group who hadn't received a bolus. And across the groups, they were all well matched for clinical severity and malaria status at baseline. And most of the fatalities, 87% of them, occurred before 24 hours from initiation of treatment. And in fact, of these, of any of the children, really very few developed the predicted adverse effects of fluid overload.
This study was all set out to prove that fluid boluses were good, and it was a question between albumin and crystalloid, and it was just a well-designed trial with no boluses being given as the control arm. So it was, in fact, one of those rare occasions where it's the control arm surprises everyone and is the one where we suddenly find out we're in fact doing harm.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, so, I mean, that's what I think was interesting about this, and certainly the researchers obviously realized this, and in fact, the trial was halted for that reason, although they have come under criticism for some aspects of that. And I think the big value of this trial is that it does, and of course, you can all imagine that one of the main criticisms is that this is very far removed from our day-to-day practice, so how can you actually explain that, or how can you transfer these findings to a Western medicine practice where children are just not as unwell or malnourished, where there's not the prevalence of malaria infection as there were in these children. But it does make you question.
How did they try and explain their findings?
Well, there's a number of... well, I should just finish mentioning the results there.
Oh,
also, the 4-week mortality was gave similar findings. So the 4-week mortality was around 12% for both groups receiving boluses without any significant difference, but only 8.7% in the control or no bolus group. And again, these kids sadly died of similar things, but malaria, coma, sepsis, acidosis, severe anemia, and so on. Like, the authors put forward that perhaps the vasoconstrictor response of shock is actually protective, and that by fluid resuscitating these children, you negated that protective effect. and or that perhaps there are other mechanisms at play, and whether there's an element of a reperfusion injury given the flu resuscitation, or whether there were issue or effects of subclinical lung compliance or myocardial function. The only other thing I was going to say is that the critics of the journal, or people who have responded, also put forward various other theories, which are just interesting to keep in mind. But someone wrote in to say this could possibly be due to worsening of the anemia. Now, 32% of these kids had a hemoglobin of less than 5, and they say that with flu resuscitation, that would have obviously been diluted further, and perhaps that could explain it. We don't really know what, I mean, there's a high level of malaria infection in these kids. 57% had severe falciparum malaria, and how that influences their clinical course. There were also some criticisms of the definitions of impaired perfusion and severe hypertension, and in an editorial in The Lancet, in fact, there was some criticism about the fact that the study protocol was actually adjusted after the recommendation to stop the trial, and there are obviously sort of ethical issues and arguments about around that. But I think everyone's in agreement that it was a, as Rick says, you know, they set out to, they constructed a very robust trial under difficult circumstances in a low resource environment, and showed some very surprising results that seem to challenge our reasonably well established approach to resuscitation of the severely unwell child.
One of the great things about the surprise result from the FEAST trial was that it's been a great piece of news for the Darwinian medicine proponents out there. On my understanding of Darwinian medicine, or one of the aspects of it, is looking at the body's response to disease and working out sort of what the evolutionary mechanism behind that is, which isn't always clear, and challenging some of the ideas of the ways we treat people. For instance, in intensive care, a lot of the very basic type things we do, like giving fluids to patient, there isn't in fact any particular evidence base for. It's just that it's been done for such a long time in an unchallenged fashion. And I think doing randomized controlled trials on these things is very difficult, because medicine as a subject is so very old and evidence medicine is so very new, that getting ethics to have an arm of your trial which is doing something that is against common sense and against normal practice, but thereby getting a good scientifically sound result, is very difficult. And I think the ethics for the FEAST trial themselves are an impressive feat.
Well, I think the ethics approval probably was granted because of the setting and the fact that it wasn't, from my understanding, is that it wasn't local practice to give fluid boluses. So, you know, that was an accepted treatment. I mean, we're talking about fluid boluses and resuscitation within the first few hours of presentation, as we would do in resus, for example, here.
Surely the question of the ethics committee has got to be, why is the why in this region is the standard treatment not to give fluid boluses? Is it because people believe that not giving fluid boluses is the correct treatment, or is it because fluid boluses aren't available?
I think it's the latter, but I mean, that may just, I might well be making that up.
Yeah, which is why presumably this was the only setting you could possibly
adopt. Yeah, I mean, you've obviously got a very valid point. I mean, you'd never be able to do this in any of the Western countries.
But I mean, the other thing is, it is a very big trial.
Yeah, it's a big trial. It's very well designed. I think it was well run, given the environment. And I think, you know, for all the criticism, it certainly caused a lot of discussion. But for all the criticism, it's got some very interesting results.
Absolutely, and I think in the future we'll be thinking very differently about who we give fluids to. So, saving the best till last, Bex, you're going to be telling us how we should be managing those Friday afternoon trauma lists.
I am. So, for my news article, I read the AAGBI draft guideline for the management of proximal femoral fractures. Certainly when I was a junior SHO, these patients formed the bread and butter of the emergency list on the weekends. And the patient profile is typically elderly with loads and loads of comorbidities. Looking at the impact that this has on the NHS, there are 77,000 hip fractures in the UK each year, of which 98% are treated surgically. This accounts for 1.5 million bed days and £800 million. The average stay post-operatively for patients is 23 days, and they have a 30-day mortality rate of about 10%. The focus of the guidelines is on early surgery with high-quality rehab with a multidisciplinary team approach and a fast-track admission pathway. And actually, much of what's in the guidelines isn't specific to hip fractures. It suggests things like dedicated lists, separate to the emergency lists, which are consultant-led, and orthogeriatric input. But there was quite a lot relevant to anaesthetics, which I thought was worth having a look at. So regarding the preoperative anaesthetic visit, they recommend that you have a much higher transfusion trigger than normal and transfuse patients with a hemoglobin less than 10, specifically if they have ischemic heart disease. With regards to looking for investigations such as an echocardiogram, they suggest that rather than wait for an echo, you actually just change your technique. And all surgery should ideally be done within 36 hours. And the reason why it's such a small window is that there isn't any evidence that suggests that patient outcome is improved by delaying surgery for more than 48 hours in order to improve the preoperative physiology. And they did give some numbers for conditions that should be treated prior to surgery, and it's a short list of a hemoglobin less than 8. You should manage a sodium which was less than 120 or greater than 150, which I think is actually quite a diverse range. Potassiums that are less than 2.8 or greater than 6 should be corrected. And then uncontrolled issues such as diabetes, left ventricular failure, or fast AF, and chest infections that are associated with sepsis. Looking at the actual anaesthetic technique that they discussed, there's no evidence that suggests either a regional or general anaesthetic is superior. But what they did recommend, which I think you do see a lot of, they recommend that you avoid both a general anaesthetic and a spinal, because, as I'm sure we've all found out, you then spend the rest of the anaesthetic scraping the blood pressure off the floor. With regards to limiting your
You rarely get a situation where you can't make your mind up, so you just do both.
I've seen a lot of consultants do that.
I mean, it's not like being indecisive about flavours of ice cream.
Well, you get pain relief and a quiet patient. It's ideal, really, isn't it? So please don't put that in.
You obviously haven't witnessed Bex's spinal technique.
Yeah, why do one good anaesthetic when you can cobble together two shit ones?
Yeah. Right. Anyway, watch it. So they recommend for spinal anaesthetic using fentanyl rather than dimorphine, as there's less postoperative cognitive dysfunction with fentanyl. And if you are going to do a general anaesthetic, this is something I've never done actually, is an inhalational induction and then using a laryngeal mask technique to maintain spontaneous ventilation, which they say has a less of a physiological derangement than intubating and paralyzing. But in my experience, the elderly patients that come down often confuse and fairly uncooperative, so I'm not sure an inhalational induction would be my technique of choice. They did recommend that you always consider peripheral nerve blockades, but not as your primary form of anaesthetic, more regarding post-operative pain relief. And then for monitoring, just the usual minimum standards that are recommended, but also very vigilant temperature control and routine use of point-of-care hemoglobin analysis, so using that routinely at the end of every operation. Post-operatively, there were no surprises. Be careful of NSAIDs in elderly people, and be careful of opioids in people with renal failure. But they did say that if there are patients with renal failure, what they thought was the best idea to do this was to use half the dose and half as frequently, rather than oral opiates, and that all patients should have supplemental oxygen for 24 hours. Post-operative care, the usual vigilance with thromboprophylaxis, and if patients do develop post-operative cognitive dysfunction, to use either haloperidol or lorazepam in the short term. So, I mean, really the guidelines, I think, just suggest that you give a decent anaesthetic. But I did think that the numbers that they gave for correcting preoperatively will help decision-making, especially in your more junior years, and will limit cancellations and postponement of surgery. And I thought they should have maybe perhaps paid a bit, given a bit more credit to the orthogeriatric teams, because I do think that, you know, orthogeriatrics have invaluable input. And most of your patients in the hospitals that I've worked at, where there is a good team involvement, have been appropriately worked up medically, and there's a, you know, a vast reduction in delays. With respect to that sodium, I mean, they are saying that they you should still try and correct it, but that you should give yourself at least 36 hours, but they should still be operated on within 48. And actually, there's no point in delaying post 48. So if you're at 48-hour time, you just need to get on with it regardless.
Yeah, it seems like quite a sporting range, especially towards the lower end. But I suppose, I mean, you also need to put it into perspective. And I mean, this patient group will often have some chronic electrolyte abnormalities for whatever reason. So
yeah,
I'm sure they're not talking about acute hypernatremia due to some other cause. And these are probably elderly patients who are on diuretics or been overhydrated iatrogenically or whatever the reason is, and you probably have a lower threshold for worrying about it. I think summary, they are quite sensible guidelines that it sounds like most of us are in agreement that, you know, there's a lot of this avoidance behavior, and, you know, certainly I work some places where patients just get postponed until the next anaesthetist list, and these patients just languish on the ward, and you do just need to get on and do them unless there's a very good reason not to.
Say, my favourite sentence in this was, the working party considers that unacceptable reasons for delaying surgery include unavailable surgical expertise.
They obviously haven't worked at many of my hospitals.
Just any shit surgeon will be fine.
There is, you know, there isn't an orthopaedic surgeon, but I've seen a couple crack on.
We've got six registrars hanging onto a jammer and a chisel.
Yeah, I did a couple of DHSs.
So we'll have one of
those,
two shit anaesthetics,
so,
so,
you know,
and six
shit
registrars.
If Mark is the only person available to do one, you know, within the 48 hours, then you should let him go ahead.
I'll come and give you my best dodgy anaesthetic whilst you crack on, Mark.
I'll give you two.
Excellent. So just before we wrap up this podcast, we will have to play my favorite game, which is Biology of Bunkum, where I am going to give my three colleagues three news stories, one of which is a fabrication of my imagination, and the other two are true. And they're going to quickly tell me which one they think is the bunkum and which two are the biology. So are you ready? Here are your three news stories from this month. Number one. The first synthetically grown meat has gone on sale in Holland. Number two, bacterial resistance to vancomycin and other antibiotics has been proven to predate medical antibiotics. Number three, a computer chip has been made that replaces the function of the cerebellum in a rat. Mark, you've got a good track record on these, so why don't you start by telling me which one of those you think is a figment of my imagination?
Oh, you're getting good at this. They all sound quite good to me. So, what was the first one again? I dismissed it because it didn't sound like bunkum, but I'm going to have to reconsider it now.
The first synthetically grown meat has gone on sale in Holland.
Surely that can be done. And antibiotics, I want to believe because antibiotic properties existed in nature before we humans managed to isolate them and use them to our advantage. So I will go with the robot rats.
The robot rats. Okay.
Mm.
Frank.
Oh, sorry. I'm going to make a strategic choice here. I'm going to go for the antibiotic.
Do you think that antibiotic resistance should have come after antibiotics became...
just because I think the other two are probably true, given your proclivity for these kinds of stories.
Okay. And Rebecca?
Yeah, probably the antibiotic thing, because, I mean, if they've been growing ears on the back of rats for years, I don't see why they can't grow meat. And I'm sure there's some scientist somewhere wanting to put a chip in a rat's brain. So I think the antibiotic stuff is rubbish.
Okay. So, in no particular order, first one I'll tell you about is the computer chip that has been made to function, do the function of the server.
I knew it! I knew it! Excellent.
This is a genuine news story. This is biology. this is biology. I've not given much away from the title, but it's some scientists who sound pretty crazy who have basically been taking out rat cerebellums, I think, and looking at the neural inputs and the outputs, and have made some sort of computer chip, which they're claiming is starting to use to do that sort of input-output function that the cerebellum does. Cerebellum, got to remember, is a fairly old bit of the brain, and therefore is relatively simple compared with the rest of it, but still obviously massively complex. The story I read wasn't hugely impressive in that what they've done is they've somehow managed to anaesthetize these rats, disconnect their cerebellum, and then while they're anaesthetized, blow air into their open eyes and see if they can coordinate some sort of blink response, which they can't do when their cerebellum is disconnected. And I don't know how you disconnect a cerebellum, but I assume the only way you can do that is chop it out with a knife. But when you then plug their spinal cord into this computer chip and then into their brain, they can, when anaesthetized, obviously not very anaesthetized, but sort of anaesthetized, they can then blink when you blow air into their open eyes.
That's bollocks. They're just having a seizure from the electricity.
This was about as much as I understood. But the bottom line is they've said they've made a computer chip that can replace the function of the cerebellum. A bold claim, but nonetheless, I'm counting that as biology. Yeah. So next, Frank and Bex, you went for bacterial resistance to vancomycin and other antibiotics. Not predating medical antibiotics, which makes sense. We hear a lot about antibiotic resistance nowadays, and it's to do with our over prescription and overuse of antibiotics, but it is in fact biology.
Right.
It's completely true. The antibiotic resistance predates human existence by several, I think probably 10 somewhere between 10 and 100 million years. Natural antibiotics have been out there, but particularly penicillin resistance and vancomycin resistance and everything else has been found in some... What they do is they drill through various ice layers and then pull out the core and then find the antibiotics, and then they use various markers to check that it's from the correct bit of history. But these are all completely... All vancomycin resistant can be found in bacteria that predate humans, let alone predate the use of vancomycin. So it's because these antibiotics are all derived from products that have... but it's because they're all plant-based stuff, basically. They're not synthetic. You were all wrong. The story that is, in fact, the bunkum is that the first synthetically grown meat has gone on sale in Holland. This was based on a story I'd read, which was looking at, it's the holy grail of meat production is being able to grow meat in a lab. And you're quite right, Bex, if you can grow an ear on the back of a mouse, why can't you make synthetically grown meat? It's got many, many advantages. One of them is that it requires far less in terms of energy usage to make meat in a lab than it does to grow an animal, feed it, water it, look after it, make sure it reproduces in sufficient quantities. In terms of energy use, greenhouse gas emissions, land use, water use, it would be fantastic if you could just grow the synthetic proteins. However, the problem is every time they do it, they don't get very many of them. And they look all sort of grey and unappetizing, and in fact they taste disgusting, and you can't make them in sufficient quantities without growing an animal. So this article was saying we're probably 10 to 20 years about from making anything that's commercially viable, but they think it will happen. The question will be, when it does happen, who's going to eat it. And the most interesting thing about this was lots of its research that's very difficult to get funded. Whilst it would be a world-changing thing in terms of energy production and the way we, you know, we get nutrients, and in fact, the fact that we're running out of space generally on the planet, not many people are interested in funding the research because it's seen as unnatural, kind of Frankenstein-type technology. But the biggest funders of this are, in fact, the PETA group. They've contributed several millions of pounds. So I think all these vegetarians are desperate to have something to eat.
Why do I want to go to youporn.com? Oh, I see. Well, on that how to grow your own meat bombshell, I think we'll end this podcast. Yeah, we hope you enjoyed it. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.